Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brent Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite little hangout as we talk a little politics. Brandon, so much going on every week. It's like, I don't know, it's like politics going around the world here in Texas.
It's like popcorn. Every time you turn around, more popping, right?
Big things going on here in Texas, talking about big changes potentially to school funding. Before we get to that, let's dive into what's going on here nationally. We've got once again, more candidates jumping in to the Democratic primary for president. Two governors. Take it away, Brandon.
Yeah, so the first I'll talk about is Jay Inslee, who's the governor of Washington. Jay pegged his focus here to climate change. That's really the one big issue he says is going to be the most critical thing the state and the nation will face. He says and brags about having 100% clean grid in Washington. If climate change isn't adopted or isn't addressed at this point, he says this is going to be kind of the downfall of our country and maybe the world. What do you think about his candidacy? And generally speaking, like, is sort of pegging your candidacy to one issue something that's rational?
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting strategy because it's essentially reinforcing this idea that the Democratic Party shift to the left. He is trying to win a primary. He sees climate change is this existential crisis that has to be dealt with. The politics of it, I think, is really what we're talking about here. I mean, I guess it makes some degree of sense, but there's just a lot of issues out there. He might feel other people, you know, have taken that lane, and he's going to try to own climate change.
Yeah.
I don't think you can really own it, one candidate.
You know what? The sad thing is probably a good VP issue, right? So if he were to be VP, he would sort of handle this one thing. But I don't think primary voters and certainly general election voters don't care that much about voting on the environment. Poll after poll has shown that. Maybe we'll see a change. I'm not sure. Another big announcement, though, is from a former governor, Jay, of Colorado.
That's right. John Hickenlooper, who, you know, we talked about this for weeks, that the Democratic primary field has been decidedly to the left. This is the first kind of moderate, centrist, Western governor, super successful governor, took on the NRA, first gun control legislation in the Mountain West that had been around for the last 50, 60 years. Really successful economy. Great governor, well-regarded governor from Colorado. Got a great story, made a bunch of money as the owner of a brew pub, which we can all be supportive of. I like John Hickenlooper. He's got an interesting story to tell. I just don't see how he fits in the sort of modern Democratic Party. I guess lightning could strike and he could be, you know, if there's no one in the center and he's it, maybe he can pick up enough voters because everyone's out in the left.
Yeah, he's a kind of right of center Democrat, right?
Well, and that's he likes to talk about himself as kind of a progressive who gets things done.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
And I think that sort of pragmatic approach certainly has some appeal, particularly when you're talking about a lot of candidates, frankly, who talk a lot, but this guy's actually done a lot. And so there's something to that.
Yeah, not to say that, you know, mayors of South Bend or members of the Senate like aren't getting things done, but he actually have a pretty strong track record, right? And like you say, he's a kind of a moderate in a state which is trending more progressive. He can claim credit for progress on healthcare, on environmental issues, marijuana decriminalization. Beto O'Rourke, who's not running, you know, at least as of the current taping, says that he wants to legalize marijuana. So this is going to become an issue, too. It's something that, you know, potentially Hickenlooper could make some movement on. But it's going to be hard to be elected as Bill Clinton, right? And that's essentially what he is, right? He's a kind of centrist Democrat that can point to, you know, having made some progress in his state on these issues. So I am not so sure, but there are also some people who aren't sure about running, like Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah.
Deadline has come and gone. What's going on, Jay?
Yeah, we talked about this before. He gave that deadline where he said he was, you know, he was going to make a decision by the end of February. Well, he did make a decision. He said he's not going to run for the Senate, and we're all waiting to see what he's going to announce. Yeah. My assumption is he's going to announce for president. They're trying to collect lists and get people to sign up. It's just a matter of when. You know, he's one of those things he kind of has to hurry up and decide,
I think so
increasingly
too.
So we are less than a year away from the Texas primary on March 2nd. So it'll be interesting to see. I still expect O'Rourke to get in.
Yeah.
The bigger the field, the smaller the base vote. And we've talked about this before. I think it plays well for Bernie Sanders just because he's got that base. He had a pretty ruckus announcement instead of announcing in Ben and Jerry's country, Vermont, yeah. where everyone, shall we say, looked exactly the same, he decides to do his announcement in Brooklyn, New York, and Chicago, Illinois, yeah. two places where he was born and where he went to school. Super diverse crowds this time, something he was heavily criticized for. So he's certainly learning from some of the missteps of 2016.
Yeah,
I wouldn't sleep on him. And, of course, the presumptive front runner of this field we're still waiting on, and that is the former Vice President Joe Biden.
Could still
is
happen.
He going to get in this race?
You know what? I think all signs point to yes if you shake your magic eight ball, but I think it's a little sort of unclear at this point. So I'm guessing so. He thinks he can kind of run the table here, in part because of the way that Hickenlooper sort of made the claim that he wants to be seen as somebody who can get things done. Well, Biden can make that case. I'm not sure it's the best move, and we'll talk about it if it happens, but we do know, for instance, that other people who have been in the mix have said no. So just this week, Hillary Clinton has said she will not run, and Eric Holder has said he will not run. So the field is getting bigger, but of course, at this, we're also having some attrition on people who are speculating about that.
Yeah, I think Biden's really the only, I'm not sure about Juggernaut Joe, running the table. I think, his prior performances have indicated that he's hardly this force when he actually has to run right. on his own without the, shall we say, the warm embrace of Barack Obama.
Yeah.
So, I'm not really convinced about that. But right now in polling, he is in the lead.
Yep.
You know what is not in the lead right now is public support for President Trump's emergency declaration. It is polling terribly, and Congress is basically blocking it now.
Right. They're playing along, right? So responsiveness to government can work, right? Congress is very likely to block President Trump's emergency declaration. The House has already done so. As of our taping today, the Senate is very likely to do so. They've got enough Republicans on board to block it, the last of which was Senator Rand Paul, who suggested that there was a separation of powers issue, which you and I talked about extensively this week and last week. So this is, I think, a pretty profound moment here. It's going to be the president's probably first veto, assuming he chooses to veto it. It's also kind of a serious pushback on a president's use of unilateral power. I think the bottom line is that when you have this kind of situation, the courts are not going to look favorably upon the president's declaration, given that Congress not only didn't give the money to the president to start, and also now is taking the step of saying that they reject the president's declaration. So I think the court's probably going to have to, now has no choice but to overturn.
Yeah, it's interesting because we were talking about this earlier, rather, about the fact that this is kind of the first time they have really rebuked him this way. It's interesting, the Russia sanctions, issues against Saudi Arabia, both of which he opposed, were almost unanimously passed out of the House and the Senate. He didn't veto it. This is kind of one signature item where you've got a large number of Republicans, or I shouldn't say large, a significant number of Republicans, enough to pass it out of the Senate. Mitch McConnell is letting it through. I mean, so you've got some folks, I think, that have concerns about what the president's doing.
There are cracks in the wall, right?
Yeah.
No pun intended, actually. But
they're like slats.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
cracks in the slats.
Some Republicans can slither through, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And, the last time a president was rebuked by his own party in this way, I can't even remember. I mean, it goes back to the Carter administration.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter.
We're trying to figure this out yesterday. So this is really a rare thing, and we should, I think, expect to see the courts play along, but this is a saga that's not going to go away.
Well, Brandon, there's been a lot of controversy now around the security clearances of Jared Kushner, the son-in-law / presidential advisor. I'll take your pick as to which is more important.
Which does he care about more?
Well, the president for years has essentially said that he did not in any way intervene with the top secret security clearance that was granted of Jared Kushner. It now looks like the president, in fact, did intervene. How serious is this?
I think it's fairly serious. This is something that the White House counsel and the chief of staff at the time, John Kelly, said was disconcerting and recommended not doing it. Jared Kushner has got all kinds of ties to countries that he's got business dealings with, and there were serious sort of security concerns about that relationship and those relationships. So this is not something which we should take lightly. This is a tremendously important role that he plays. Now, the president could have chosen to put him in some other fashion in the White House and had work on a project which would be equally important, but he wanted him to do this as well as some other things. So this is something clearly where the president has said, I have the power to do this. Kellyanne Conway came out and said the president can give security clearance to anybody that he likes. That may or may not be true given the structure of how it works, but it may not be advisable.
Yeah, I think the optics of it look bad, and that's really what fundamentally this is. The president, I think, is arguable whether or not he has sort of that fiat authority
right.
to grant top secret clearance to anyone he wants. But let's just say, for argument's sake, he does. A fundamental question to me is, should he? And this is an instance where he probably should not have, particularly, again, where it's a member of his family,
yeah.
Regardless of the role. So just the optics of it look terrible.
Well, speaking of optics, Jay, the president was at a meeting of CPAC. This is the Conservative Political Action Committee. They have an annual big blowout event. It's basically like, you know, the Super Bowl for conservatives. Everybody comes and gives speeches. The president was no exception this time. He was greeted very warmly. This was a bizarre speech, to put it mildly, Jay. It begins with him hugging the American flag, right? I'm sure you've seen pictures of this, right? And is a winding, sometimes rant about a range of things, about socialism, about witch hunts against him, about the investigations involving him and his family, the Green New Deal. He decried immigrants and members of Congress who hate our country. He talked about white-haired senators. And, of course, the old trope everyone loves, how big his inaugural crowd was. Jay, this was more like a stand-up routine or like Night at the Improv or something than a political speech. Is it going to hurt the president, and or is it going to help the president?
It was like the greatest hits of Trump crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it was this sort of kind of stream of consciousness, unhinged, yeah. just a 4 years of just the best
pent up crazy. Just anger, disappointment,
yeah.
displeasure.
And to think that, you know, I don't want our listeners to think we're exaggerating, and I want to give you one perfect example. Even aside from the craziness around the Green New Deal or socialism and Democrats or just basic things like weird little crazy stories about migrants coming to the United States that they're given thousands of pills, contraceptive pills to prevent them because they're going to be raped.
Yeah.
Right? As if consuming 1,000 pills is how oral contraception works. I mean, it was just kind of unhinged.
I'll see your story and raise you one. He was talking about meeting generals in Iraq, and he was naming off different people. And he said that one general's name was Raisin. And he made fun of this general's name, Raisin, for a while to the general, and then brought the story to CPAC to talk about making fun of the general. Just really odd, right? He said early on, within about 10 minutes, that, you know, he was going to go off script for like a 2-hour speech, Jay. 2-hour speech. I think he needs to stay on script right now. The president, of course, is going to run for re-election. The question for him is whether or not he can maintain the kind of core base that already supports him. That's not hard to do, but he does need to make sure he sticks on some kind of a message, because these kinds of things are not helping.
Well, you know who also needs to keep some of that staying on message is the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump.
Right.
We know that that the president oftentimes goes off script. He says crazy things, just like he did at CPAC. She's actually been very good about being disciplined and showing a tremendous amount of measure in her comments. She was, at the Gridiron Dinner, and which is a, by definition, kind of a fun and joking event. But she laid out with a series of jokes that I think reinforce something we already know. Being President Trump's daughter is the hardest job in the world.
Right. I think she was pretty lighthearted about it. She's probably one of the more likable members of the Trump
yeah,
family.
She might be the only really likable member of the Trump family.
Melania Trump is on the Be Best tour, so she's trying to kind of increase her favorables, which I think can happen for first ladies. It's not a bad option. She can kind of soften the image of the president, but they haven't worked it in such a way that I think, and from a communications perspective, that it's really that successful for the White House overall.
Yeah, Eric Trump, of course, and Donald Jr. Interestingly enough, Donald Jr. has become kind of a conservative darling.
Right.
He spoke at CPAC as well and has really raised his stature among many Republican activists. And he's, in fact, sought after as a surrogate for President Trump as much as anyone.
Yeah. Well, let's switch to talk about Texas. There are some legal controversies here as well. So Representative Victoria Nevey from Dallas has been sued by several Dallas County taxing entities over unpaid property taxes to the tune of about $27,000. She has said in a statement that she's working to resolve it. She fell behind, basically admitting that this is what was happening. What's your take on kind of where this is going to leave her?
Yeah, I think the problem here for her is that this is rental property, it's investment property for her, that she just didn't, her eye wasn't on it. It the fact that it's gotten to the point of suing, because it's important for people to recognize it takes a long time to get to this stage. There was ample opportunity for her to resolve it earlier. It didn't. I'm not quite sure why it's taking this long for her to resolve it. She chose not to, and now she's in a position of being embarrassed by it.
Yeah. Well, Jay, we're recording on a Tuesday here in Texas, so if it's a Tuesday in Texas, there's bound to be a special election someplace. We've got two, actually, that we can track. One is House District 145, which is here in Houston. It's the sort of southeast part of Houston. It pits Christina Morales against Melissa Noriega. It's been a kind of low-key affair so far. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's special elections, by and large, don't really draw a lot of people. This is the runoff to a special election in the middle of the legislative session. People, I think, you know, this is one of those races that's going to get decided by early vote.
Yeah.
You know, not that we want to discourage people from going out to the polls on election day, but generally speaking, when the turnout is this low, it's pretty much sort of decided early.
Yeah.
I think Christina Morales led going into the runoff. She sort of is in a position, I think, to probably win. Melissa Noriega is really a great candidate. She got the endorsement of the Houston Chronicle, the local paper here, and has a ton of support from activists, Democratic activists. So it's going to be, I think, a close race. The edge probably goes to Morales, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, they made this race about kind of experience versus new blood. That's something that the party has really grappled with. So I think, you know, Melissa Noriega says that she's more qualified. She's been, you know, more active and she's done more things. She doesn't raise as much money as Christina Morales. So I don't think this is going to be about money. But if it were, you know, Morales would have an edge. There's also an election in San Antonio, again, in House District 125. This is kind of northwest portion of San Antonio. You've got former city councilman Ray Lopez running against Republican Fred Rangel, who ended up getting more because in the 38% in the primary. What's going to happen there?
Yeah, I think Lopez is probably likely to win pretty comfortably. I mean,
we also have seen Republicans show up in big numbers and Democrats not in San Antonio specials.
Well, right, exactly. It's, Pete Flores famously won an upset Texas Senate seat against Pete Gallego in large part because of that. Now, that district was much closer partisan-wise. Democrats didn't have a really large advantage there.
Yeah.
This is one, this particular state house seat, I think, has a 60-40 Democratic advantage.
Yeah.
It should be Lopez's to lose.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean he won't, but it should be his to lose.
We've seen this go the other way. Well, I think that it's probably right. And Lopez is really playing to Democratic strengths, talking about, you know, job creation, veteran services stuff, as well as healthcare. Rangel's talked more about property tax relief and abortion politics. So it's definitely playing to the Republican-Democrat split. The likelihood is that Lopez will win as a Democrat, but who knows? Hey, speaking of who knows, we are in the middle of a kind of round robin here in discussion about who's going to run against John Cornyn in 2020. Jay, where are we on that?
Man, it's interesting how much interest the 2020 election has gotten for not just president, but here in Texas. And it shows to the how competitive the state has become. There are multiple Democrats talking about running against John Cornyn. Cornyn is viewed as one of the most vulnerable people among the statewide elected officials. He's the least popular statewide elected among the major elected officials here. And so you've got Kim Olson, who is the Democratic nominee for Agriculture Commissioner, ran a strong race against our friend Sid Miller, Crazy Sid. Finished short. And
Yosemite
she's got,
Sid.
Yosemite Sid. Yeah, she's got a sort of this kind of this groundswell support she's trying to engender to get people up. Now, she had some issues in the campaign, didn't raise as much money as some people had wanted, but so she's in the mix. MJ Hager, we talked about before, who narrowly lost to John Carter in a congressional race, raised a tremendous amount of money virally. She is a decorated military veteran, really strong candidate with an interesting message. Might be the kind of candidate that would have a lot of appeal. Amanda Edwards, who's a council member on Houston City Council, her name has been bandied about as a potential candidate. Very telegenic, very charismatic. Harris County is the biggest part of the state, as we all know. So having someone with a lot of strength there can make a lot of sense. She's also African-American, adds a lot in terms of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And last, but certainly not least, is the person that I think a lot of people want to run, and that is Congressman Joaquin Castro out of the San Antonio area.
I think everyone's waiting for him to decide, and then sort of decide from there what to do. You know, I think Joaquin is a good position, right? I mean, the Democrats want to see a Latino candidate to spur Latino votes. He's also young and fairly progressive. One downside is that his brother Julian is running for president, so there's going to be a lot of kind of Cain and Abel situations there, right, where what is affecting something for Julian at the national level may affect Joaquin at the local level. Castro, Julian Castro, in polling is not well known, even among Hispanics, and that's a real potential problem, and also only has a favorable opinion of about 24% of young voters and women voters. That's a potential problem. Now, they're not obviously the same person, but that name ID does not spread the way that you might think it would. But like you say, Cornyn's really vulnerable. I mean, his fave-unfave split is 36-35. That's pretty low. And 29% of people don't have enough information to make a decision about him. There's a base problem for him, too. Only 41% of voters with no college degree have ever heard about him. In the changing electorate, he's really low. 16% of young voters and 36% of women and 22% of Hispanics have a favorable opinion of him. If the same electorate turns out in 20 has turned out in 18, he's going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, I think Castro would clearly be the best option for Democrats in a statewide candidate. Two things are going for him. One, right now in the polling, somebody not named Donald Trump will beat Donald Trump.
Right.
That's essentially what the polling says. The generic Democrat beats Donald Trump. In Texas, right. Brandon, it's a new day.
That will change. Tone of the election comes.
Sure,
out.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's an important thing because that's never happened in a DNR split in Texas in the last four, five, six cycles. So you do that combined with the fact that you have an incumbent U.S. senator that's not that popular in John Cornyn, and Castro, more than the other candidates, has the potential to change the turnout model. We talk about the Latino community, sort of the sleeping giant. Having a strong, relatively well-known Latino candidate at the top on the Senate side can be a game changer. So if Joaquin Castro is the Democratic nominee, John Cornyn is in big trouble. The interesting thing about the timing element is there. He doesn't have to really let it be known until much later in the process, largely because I think he's waiting to see what's going on with Julian.
Yeah. Well, Jay, we talked about marijuana as being a potential issue in 2020, but the Texas legislature is getting a jump on that. There have been about 30 bills that are filed in decriminalizing marijuana in some way, some medical issues, some general full legalization. So there's been a lot of stuff going on. What do you think is going to happen in terms of the marijuana legislation in Texas?
Well, we've seen sort of a sea change in the public's attitude towards marijuana, and it's been bipartisan. The most interesting thing to me is that both the Democratic and the Republican state platforms advocate for the decriminalization of marijuana. That just never happened. Right. I think we've had multiple sessions in the past where you've seen movement to try to decriminalize it in some form. I suspect you'll start to see it this session. You'll probably see some form. Almost certainly medical marijuana will be decriminalized this session. I don't see for recreational use, but I do think you're probably going to see a decriminalization for medical usage and probably some controlled studies moving forward. You can always tell when these things happening because you can see the private sector moving in, and you're already seeing sort of individuals looking at licenses and how that process working potentially would work. And I think the governor is somewhat amenable to it now.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a real question here because the governor said that he would be willing to support some decriminalization but is not on board with expanding medical marijuana beyond the current use, which is pretty limited to people who have a certain kind of epilepsy. So he's the real kind of linchpin here. But as you say, there's a lot of bipartisan support, so it could be that they work on him enough to get him to move on that. You've got legislation involved with decriminalization. You've got pushes, you know, towards making medical marijuana more expansive for individuals, and you've got institutional support behind it, right? Joe Moody, who's really pushed this, is the vice chair of the Calendars Committee. You've got four other committee chairs, Republican and Democrat, who've signed on board with different phases of decriminalization. So there's a lot of movement in that direction, but it's going to be baby steps, right? It's going to be small incremental changes towards that. Even a place like California, which, you know, now it legalizes, it took 20 years for it to get to this point. So I don't expect to see Texas move overnight, but definitely it's the case that we're moving in that direction.
Well, Brandon, the big topic this legislative session has been reforming the way public schools are funded. Dan Huberty, the chairman of the Texas House Education Committee, sort of been spearheading this effort, finally released kind of the big omnibus House version of the bill. It's a couple hundred pages long. Totally redoes school funding, adds over $7 billion into public education, lowers the property tax rate down that schools would be able to do by about 4 or 5 cents. lots of changes, lots to unpack here. We know that the Senate has already passed a $5,000 a pay raise for teachers and librarians. Public education is kind of getting a day, but this Huberty bill is a big bill. Looks like it's going to have momentum to pass the House pretty easily. But then the question is kind of how they reconcile these different approaches.
Well, they've got a lot of support. And I think that for Republicans and Democrats alike, it's important because that's the difficult sort of hurdle, right? Now, we talked about last week, the Republicans and Democrats may not see eye to eye on the total amount of money. Of course, Democrats would agree to spend more, but how much more is the question. Now, the budget itself allows for this money. I mean, the comptroller basically suggested it's about $9 billion more than this biennium, the last biennium. So this money is being spent on that. My question is twofold. Number one, how does this gel with property tax reform more broadly, right? Because that's going to be a very expensive tab. Greg Abbott wants a 2.5% rollback rate. It's not going to be probably that low, but it'll be something which will cost billions of dollars. But the second part of this is that you've got effectively a $9 billion bill now, but will it be sustainable in the future, right? Will the legislature agree to spend this money in perpetuity? Because that's the way it's structured. That's a good question because the state doesn't like to spend a lot of money on this. So I don't know how it's going to work out in terms of the longevity of it, but it's certainly a good start at making some big changes.
Yeah, that's where the issue is, right? The compromise element. The way the Huberty bill is structured, I think, is a little bit different in that it does two things. One, it adds more money into the base allotment for what we spend on education. That should continue moving forward. So that sort of permanently changes the fiscal implications for the state in terms of how much it spends on education. The other part is it drives down the actual hard rate that a local property taxpayer would pay for their school bill down 4 to 5 cents. That is an immediate reduction. It's going to end up being about $200 to $300 a year on your property tax bill. That's a radically different approach than what the Democrats are saying, which is an expansion of homestead exemption, or what the governor wants, which is a cap on how fast your property taxes can rise in terms of appraisal. So there are three completely different approaches. The interesting thing is how they're going to harmonize all three. I don't think the Democratic version is going to get much daylight. There's some ideas in there that might work. Homestead exemptions in particular, because it targets the relief to just homeowners. I think Huberty's version has a ton of support in the House, certainly bipartisan support. The Senate plan, and let me put a plug in for Dan Patrick for a moment, because I know it's going to shock everyone. But this plan spends $5,000 per teacher across the board and librarians. The big deal here is that oftentimes we'll say spending goes up, it never makes it down to the schoolhouse. This approach drives money directly to the schoolhouse because it pays for teachers, doesn't pay for administrators, doesn't pay for programs, pays directly to teachers. Now,
that's separate from the Republican bill.
Yeah,
from higher for Ed here. I still wonder. I mean, the Democrats have got a lot of stuff chalked into their plan. They were asking for about $15 billion. There's a lot of things like stipends for classroom and stabilizing the teacher retirement system. So these are a little more spendy than the Republicans put out there. But it is definitely going to be the case that they're going to push for more because this is the number one issue for both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, and let's not forget, the Huberty bill, like the Democratic bill, funds pre-K for all.
Yeah.
About 95% of pre-K for all gets funded under Huberty's bill.
The governor's going to like that, right?
Yeah,
that's his thing.
So there's a lot in the Huberty bill for people to like. This is not what we normally expect coming out of the Texas legislature on both sides. I think it's been a really productive time for them.
Well, this is the first drop on a very long trail drive, so we'll see how it plays out. But it's good to see them addressing these big issues.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
A big thanks to our producer, Sophie Mall and Ernie Manus. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the educator, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.